Colonial administrator Cadwallader Colden declared in 1749, "They had such absolute notions of liberty that they allow of no kind of superiority of one over another, and banish all servitude from their territories." Colden, who later became vice-governor of New York, was an adoptee of the Mohawks. Rogers and Colden admired these Indians, but not every European did. "The savage does not know what it is to obey," complained the French explorer Nicolas Perot in the 1670s. "Indians think everyone ought to be left to his own opinion without being thwarted," the Jesuit Louis Hennepin wrote 20 years later. "The Indians," he grumbled, "believe what they please and no more," a practice dangerous, in Hennepin's view, to a well-ordered society. "There is nothing so difficult to control as the tribes of America," another Jesuit unhappily observed. "All these barbarians have the law of wild asses. They are born, live, and die in a liberty without restraint. They do not know what is meant by bridle and bit." Indian insistence on personal liberty was accompanied by an equal insistence on social equality. Northeastern Indians were appalled by the European propensity to divide themselves into social classes, with those on the lower rungs of the hierarchy compelled to defer to those on the upper. The French adventurer, Louis Armand de Landarcet, Baron of Lahontan, lived in French Canada between 1683 and 1694, and frequently visited the Huron. When the Baron expatiated upon the superior practices of Europe, the Indians were baffled. The Huron, he reported in an account of his American years, could not understand why one man should have more than another, and that the rich should have more respect than the poor. "They brand us for slaves and call us miserable souls, whose life is not worth having, alleging that we degrade ourselves in subjecting ourselves to one man, a king, who possesses the whole power and is bound by no law but his own will. Individual Indians value themselves above anything that you can imagine, and this is the reason they always give for it. That one's as much master as another, and since men are all made of the same clay, there should be no distinction or superiority among them." Lahontan's works, immensely popular, were translated into English almost as soon as they appeared. 25 editions appeared in France over the next half century, and his vision of an American paradise seemed to have fed into the views of Voltaire, Rousseau, and Diderot. Still, those writers would likely have been thinking of Indians without him. The essayist Montaigne had noted the same anti-authoritarian attitudes a century earlier. "Indians who visited France," he wrote, "noticed among us some men gorged to the full with things of every sort, while their other halves were beggars at their doors, emaciated with hunger and poverty. They found it strange that these poverty-stricken halves should suffer, that is, tolerate, such injustice, and that they did not take the others by the throat or set fire to their houses. I asked 7 anthropologists, archaeologists, and historians if they would rather have been a typical citizen of Europe or the Haudenosaunee in 1491. None was delighted by the question, because it asked them to judge the past by the standards of today. A fallacy disparaged as presentism by social scientists. But every one of the 7 chose the Indians. Some early colonists gave the same answer. The leaders of Jamestown tried to persuade Indians to transform themselves into Europeans. Embarrassingly, almost all of the traffic was the other way. Scores of English joined the locals despite promises of dire punishment. The same thing happened in New England. Puritan leaders were horrified when some members of a rival English settlement began living with the Massachusetts Indians. My ancestor's desire to join them led to trumped-up murder charges for which he was executed. Or, anyway, that's what my grandfather told me. "When an Indian child has been brought up among us," Franklin lamented in 1753, "taught our language and habituated to our customs, yet if he goes to see his relations and makes one Indian ramble with them, there is no persuading him ever to return. But when white persons of either sex have been taken prisoners young by the Indians, and lived a while among them, though ransomed by their friends, and treated with all imaginable tenderness to prevail with them to stay among the English. Yet in a short time they become disgusted with our manner of life, and take the first good opportunity of escaping again into the woods, when there is no reclaiming them. Influenced by their proximity to Indians, by being around living, breathing role models of human liberty, European colonists adopted their insubordinate attitudes, which troubled the power elite of France, the historian Cornelius J. Genin observed. Baron D'Arcy was an example, despite his noble title. His account highlighted the Indians' freedoms as an incitement toward rebellion. In Voltaire's Candide, the eponymous hero is saved from death at the hands of an imaginary group of Indians only when they discover that he is not, as they think, a priest. The author's sympathy with the anti-clerical, anti-authoritarian views of Indians, he called Orions, is obvious. Both the clergy and Louis XIV, the king whom Baron D'Arcy was goading, tried to suppress these dangerous ideas by instructing French officials to force a French education upon the Indians, complete with lessons in deferring to their social betters. The attempts, Genin reported, were everywhere unsuccessful. In the most direct way, Indian liberty made indigenous villages into competitors for colonists' allegiance. Colonial societies could not become too oppressive, because their members, surrounded by examples of free life, always had the option to vote with their feet. It is likely that the first British villages in North America, thousands of miles from the House of Lords, would have lost some of the brutally graded social hierarchy that characterized European life. But it is also clear that they were infused by the democratic, informal brashness of Native American culture. That spirit alarmed and discomfited many Europeans, tough and peasant alike. But many others found it a deeply attractive vision of human possibility. Scholars have long acknowledged such borrowings as moccasins, maize, and military tactics, the Indian-style guerrilla skirmishes with which the rebellious colonists bedeviled British soldiers. In this country, General John Forbes argued in 1758, we must comply and learn the art of war from enemy Indians. With such adaptive changes, as the historian James Axtell has called them, Europeans employed Indian technology and tactics to achieve their goals. But they did not change how they viewed themselves or the world. According to an influential essay Axtell published in 1981, the most important role Indians played in the evolution of the United States was as military foes and cultural foes, to be the otherness that colonists reacted against. The whole colonial experience of trying to solve a related series of Indian problems had much to do with giving the colonists an identity indissolubly linked to America, he wrote. Collectively recoiling from the native population of the Americas, Europeans learned how to become a new version of themselves. Here, though, most U.S. historians have stopped. They have seen the Algonquian and Iroquoian-speaking societies they encountered in the Northeast as too different from British societies to have exerted lasting changes on them. How could these hierarchical, acquisitive, market-oriented, monotheistic, ethnocentric newcomers have absorbed ideas and customs from the egalitarian, reciprocal, non-capitalistic, pantheistic, ethnocentric natives? The suggestion that the Haudenosaunee could have had an impact on the American character is naive, according to Alan Taylor of the University of California at Davis, because it minimizes the cultural divide separating consensual natives from coercive colonists. Perhaps so, but then skeptics must explain why the cultural divide between Indians and Spaniards, who did deeply influence each other, was so much smaller. The historian Francis Jennings has wondered how Iroquois propagandists, as he calls them, can cite Benjamin Franklin's words about Indians, as I just did, given his oft-expressed contempt for ignorant savages. But people believe what they want to believe in the face of logic and evidence. The argument is baffling. It is like claiming European Americans were not culturally affected by African Americans because they reviled and oppressed them. Cultural influence is difficult to pin down in documents and concrete actions. Nevertheless, it exists. In 1630, John Winthrop led what was then the largest party of would-be colonists from Britain, some 700 people, to Massachusetts, where they founded the city of Boston. As the expedition was underway, the deeply religious Winthrop explained his vision of what the new colony should become. A city upon a hill. The city would be ruled by the principles of the Pilgrim's God. Among these principles, the supreme deity loves each person equally, but he did not intend them to play equal roles in society. God Almighty in his most holy and wise providence hath so disposed of the condition of mankind, as in all times some must be rich, some poor, some high and eminent in power and dignity, others mean and in submission. Winthrop's ideal community, that is, was not a place of equal opportunity, nor a place where social distinctions were erased. The mean circumstances of the poor were, in all times, part of God's plan, and could not be greatly changed if poor people got too far behind, the rich were supposed to help them. The social ideal was responsible adherence to religiously inspired authority, not democratic self-rule. The reality turned out to be different. Instead of creating Winthrop's vision of an ordered society, the Pilgrims actually invented the raucous, ultra-democratic New England town meeting. A system of governance, the Dartmouth historian Colin Calloway observes, that displays more attributes of Algonquian government by consensus than of Puritan government by the divinely ordained. To me, it seems unlikely that the surrounding Indian example had nothing to do with the change. Accepting that indigenous societies influenced American culture opens up fascinating new questions. To begin with, it is possible that native societies could also have exercised a malign influence. This is why the subject is not necessarily pious or romantic primitivism. As the Oxford historian Felipe Fernandez Armesto has complained, look to the southeast where, as Taylor has noted, colonial societies sustained a slave system more oppressive than anything practiced in Europe, and the slave owners relied on Indians to catch runaways. There too, the native groups, descended from Mississippian societies, were far more hierarchical and autocratically ruled than the Algonquian and Iroquoian-speaking groups in the Northeast. As Galley has documented, indigenous societies cooperated fully with the slave trading system, sending war captives to colonists for sale overseas. In the Northeast, by contrast, the Wendat, Huron, and Haudenosaunee either killed or, more common, adopted captives. Involuntary servitude, though it occurred, was strikingly rarer. On the map, the division line between slave and non-slave societies occurs in Virginia, broadly anticipating the Mason-Dixon line that later split slave states from free. The repeated pattern doubtless has to do with geography. Southeastern climate and soil favor plantation crops like tobacco and cotton, and southern colonists' preference for slavery presumably reflected their different ethnic, class, and religious backgrounds. But can one readily dismiss the different Indian societies who lived in these places? And if not, to what extent are contemporary American conflicts over race the playing out, at least in part, of a cultural divide that came into being hundreds of years before Columbus? To my eye, historians have been puzzlingly ready to dismiss such connections. Some of the reluctance may be a holdover from a long dormant intellectual battle in which academics and activists squared off about the purported Haudenosaunee role in the U.S. Constitution, a battle that left a bad taste in the mouth for both sides. Part of it may be a simple reluctance to credit that the culture of liberty held so essential to the identity of the United States could have so many different forebears. Think of I. Bernard Cohen, The distinguished historian who studied the thought of the framers of the Constitution, claiming that Enlightenment philosophers derived their ideas of freedom from Newtonian physics, when a plain reading of their writings shows that they took many of their illustrations of liberty from indigenous examples. So did the Boston colonists who held their anti-British Tea Party dressed as Mohawks. When others took up European intellectuals' books and histories, images of Indian freedom exerted an impact far removed in time and space from the 16th century Northeast. For much the same reason as their confreres in Boston, protesters in South Korea, China, and Ukraine wore Native American makeup in, respectively, the 1980s, 1990s, and the first years of this century. So accepted now around the world is the idea of the implicit equality and liberty of all people that it is hard to grasp what a profound change in human society it represented. But it is only a little exaggeration to claim that everywhere that liberty is cherished, Britain to Bangladesh, Sweden to Soweto, people are children of the Haudenosaunee and their neighbors. Imagine. Here, let me now address non-Indian readers. Somehow meeting a member of the Haudenosaunee from 1491. Is it too much to speculate that beneath the swirling tattoos, asymmetrically trimmed hair, and bedizened robes, you would recognize someone much closer to yourself, at least in certain respects, than your own ancestors? This is Daryl Dennis. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, by Charles C. Mann. This program was directed by Jill Whitesides. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2005-2006 by Charles C. Mann. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.